The Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch is the newly minted president of Interfaith Alliance. A writer, editor, and religious activist, Paul has spent time in academics as well as leadership positions at Huffington Post Religion and BeliefNet. The non-sectarian nature of that work made it inherently interfaith. After years in a senior position at Auburn Seminary, most recently, Paul was with Interfaith America. Paul is in New York City. State of Belief listeners certainly know longtime host Reverend Welton Gaddy well. President of Interfaith Alliance from 1998 to 2015, Welton joins us from his home in Monroe, Louisiana. And I had the pleasure to lead Interfaith Alliance from 2015 until earlier this year. So we've got a lot of institutional memory in this conversation. This won't be just an interview, rather a discussion that explores how Interfaith Alliance was born for a time such as this, and how stories and public conversations can help engage Americans with the critical work of defending true religious freedom and democracy itself. Welton and Paul, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Paul, I'm going to dive in with you right away. You've spent a lot of time building religious media entities. Why has that been so attractive to you?
I think it's a lot about what you started with, stories. What are we going to be, you know, what are stories that can invite people into a shared experience to illuminate what is important in people's lives, and also to be able to tell, imagine a society and how religion can interact with a society in a positive way. And diverse religious traditions have, each one of them has something to offer and many things to offer. So the goal with all of my work in media has been to lift up stories that sometimes have not been heard, and to learn from one another and grow empathy and grow understanding and imagine a future together. So that has been a driving principle.
So I want to know a little bit more about that. Can you remember a time or two from either HuffPo Religion and or BeliefNet when you really felt validated about the importance of that work? Is there a story topic where having high-profile, religion-oriented professional journalism in the mainstream made a real difference?
Well, one early story was, and this is controversial, but it was interesting, is that there was an end of the world movement that was happening that was so kind of random and so like some person just saying, hey, it's going to end this day. And people like were surprising numbers of people were buying it. And so this was when we first really had our team together, and Javed Kalim, who is a wonderful religion reporter, had just joined the team, and this was one of his first stories. And I said, I want you to embed with someone who believes this. And I want you to really go deep on like why they believe it, how they believe it, what effect it has on their life, and not to just like immediately say, oh, they're stupid, or they're just like, you know, ignorant, because, you know, these are people who are trying to find meaning. Now, I would say that they were being misled, and they were being misled, but we wanted to come at religion stories with respect and generosity towards people, because recognizing that no one is disposable, no one is, you know, is beyond, you know, us trying to understand one another. And so what we created, instead of having like the easy piece, which we could have done, which is like, look at all these idiots. Instead, we had him go deep, you know, find out about like the hurt in people's lives and why they were open to this idea and why they were hopeful about this idea, the end of the earth and what it meant to them. So that's an example of me trying to not take the immediate sort of dismissive approach, but a little bit more try to go deep. And in that way, understand why people might be motivated by things that personally I don't have affinity with, but want to understand better so that I can be in conversation with them.
That's great. How about you, Welton? We talked a little bit about this a few weeks ago. You had written a number of books already. So what made a radio program and a podcast seem like the right way to reach more people?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I didn't come to what I was doing to do that, but we began to see there's not a lot of people when I came to my work not a lot of people who knew anything about multiple different religions and how people who want to be in religion and people who don't want to be religion, and can we bring those two together? Also, when I came to my job, nobody wanted to talk about religion and nobody wanted to talk about politics. And then everything changed, because at that point, then people who were politicians were talking about religion and religious people were talking about politics. And so all of that was clashing, and somebody needed to say, we need to do some separation on that, but we also need to know how to bring together ourselves and do something for our nation. It was fun to do that. And let me just say this, too. I think this is important. A lot of people were on the air at this point. Most of them thought that they had to speak loudly and radically, and I didn't want to do that. And Interfaith Alliance did not want to do that. When I went on Air America, I told the leaders that our show would have certain values in it. Truth, for example, diversity, no denunciations on the air. People of all kinds of religion would be on the air, as well as people of no religion. We wanted disagreements on our program, but we didn't want fights. We wanted people who were working with each other with some respect for each other. So I just felt like we were doing something that no one else was really doing at that point.
I have to say, like, hearing State of Belief on Air America Radio, it was the first time that I had ever heard a religion discussion that seemed to actually care about what I thought. I mean, it was such a breath of fresh air. It gave me hope to hear your voice on there as someone who himself was religious, but was talking to people from all different backgrounds. And as someone who you didn't know from Adam, you know, was just, but listening in my car or listening at home and saying, oh my God, like, I am not alone in this world or my small little circle, but actually we're part of a national conversation. It was absolutely revolutionary in the best sense of that word. And we're bearing the fruits of it now, but I just want to make sure I interject that because it was so important in my own development.
Thank you, Paul. That is really important. And Welton, I just want to amplify what Paul is saying here and ask you about some of your favorite guests. I know you have featured thousands of people on this show, and I know that Ray Kirstein, our producer, has some clips ready to go. Let's talk about some of those guests. Who are some of your favorites?
I simply cannot not talk first about Walter Cronkite, who had helped us get started with Interfaith Alliance. And Walter and I got to be very good friends. And the first person we had on the show was Walter Cronkite. And it was because Walter Cronkite asked me if he could be the first person on there so that he could put his stamp on it. And of course, what I said to you just a few minutes ago about the need for truth and diversity and all of that, he had done that. And he had been one that people had found they could trust, knowing that this guy was not going to lead them along.
There has been a general trend that has bothered me. The fact that religion has been brought so much to the fore of our political discussion these days bothers me. Mm-hmm. I don't think it belongs there. case for a political movement or idea or individual is quite important to our democracy, quite clearly. I think it is well if we can look toward them and say, well, they are faithful to their faith, but they are not trying to force their faith upon me as a fellow member of their democracy. That is most important in my considerations.
Yeah, who else?
I guess the other first one I would say is Rachel Maddow. Rachel and I got together very early.
You were both on Air America when it started.
We were both on there. And first time I met her, she said, why don't you come over here and do my show? And I said, I'll be glad to do that if you'll come over here and do mine. And and all of the time after that, we were good friends. And when we were together, and I don't even know why this happened, but people told us that, and we both told each other that. We talked to each other in a way that was different than we were talking about any other time, because she didn't want to do anything but ask me questions, and I didn't want to do anything but ask her questions. And neither one of us would just say, no, we're not going to do that. We're both going to do exactly what this is. We're going to find out about each other.
You wrote these words: I have deep faith 2017 will be more of a hoot than we're expecting. Rachel, what happened?
A hoot, I mean, in a technical sense of that term. That's a term of art, really. I'd love to say it was an acronym for something much more short, deep. I am the energy that I feel for my own work right now is a surprise and a pleasure. Like, we are in a dark place as a country, and the health of our republic and our democracy and the example of our government is all in pretty bad straits. But there's also a lot of work to do that is energizing. Mm-hmm. I do not feel enervated. I do not feel drained. I do not feel depressed. I feel like, all right, then, we were made for this. Like, let's show everybody what we're made of.
I have to say, Congressman John Lewis, listen, I was walking on the holy ground, I felt, when I talked with him. And he was so good. We got on the plane together some, and that helped. But I remember one time, one evening, I had something that I wanted to do with him. I didn't know that we had any chance of getting it, but I called him, and he said, yeah, at the end of the day, and I will talk with you. And it was just a John Lewis moment of getting people not only informed, but getting people inspired. I also remember, I don't remember whether you were there that night, but it was a Democratic Party gathering. And I met him walking out that night after it was over. And I waved at him and I said, you got a moment? Of course I have a moment for you all. And then we had a whole group of people around us with them listening to us. And I can't tell you what John Lewis meant to me.
Congressman Lewis, we've seen religion in campaigns that has not been very pretty. Is religion going to play a significant role in the campaign this time?
Well, it is my hope and my prayer that religion shouldn't be a major factor, a major role in any political campaign. It doesn't mean that we check our faith at the door,
right,
and our religious values, but we shouldn't vote for people or against people because of their religious beliefs.
We have seen in recent weeks with the statements of some of the Catholic bishops and others, a kind of redefinition of religious freedom that's not quite like what's in the Constitution itself. Do you feel like that great value is on sound footing, or are we going to have to fight for religious freedom again?
It's my greatest fear, again, that we may have to go down that road. It would not be a good thing to do, but we may have to stand up and fight for religious freedom. We should be free to respect the religious values and views of all of the citizens of this country.
I don't know anybody that knows more about freedom than you do and has any more courage to work on it than what you've done. We are very grateful to you for the contributions you've made to helping this nation get somewhere close to where our Constitution was leading us. And I want to thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for all that you do. And thank you for your leadership and for your vision.
Wow. Wow.
Two of the most inspiring faith leaders of our time, Bishop Gene Robinson, the first gay bishop in the Episcopal Church. Gene is always such a clear moral voice on LGBT issues. And in more recent years, he has always made sure to stress how economic justice, racial justice have to be just as big a priority as justice for LGBT people.
With God, there is always hope. And on those days when I can't believe it myself, I put my belief in God, and through God, I can be somewhat hopeful, because the world often gets it wrong, the church often gets it wrong, but God never gets it wrong. And with God, we can do astounding things. So for me, the experience of encountering that kind of hate immediately threw me back onto God. And I literally could not have done any part of what I've been able to do without God.
And Jane Holmes Dixon, the second woman consecrated as a bishop in the Episcopal Church. She was a spiritual person who did not mind working for justice in all places.
When did you decide to study for the ministry?
I was confronted by a woman who's a great mentor in my life, Dr. Verna Dozier, African-American woman here in Washington who was head of the English department for the D.C. public schools. And I was telling her at lunch one day that I was sure that our son David, who was at the time 12 or 13, was going to be a priest. And she looked at me and she said, "Listen here, if you want to be a priest, you do it, but you leave that boy alone." I rode the train home shortly after that, and my husband picked me up at Union Station, and I told him what Dr. Dozier had said to me, and I thought he was going to laugh and say, "Well, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard." And what he said was, "I think she may be right."
Somebody else I will always treasure knowing was Bishop John Shelby Spong. He kept writing books, one book after another, well into his 80s. And each time one of those books came out, he would agree to be with us again for open, humble, witty, and wise conversations.
I grew up in a Christian church, an Episcopal church, as a matter of fact, in Charlotte, North Carolina, that taught me that segregation was the will of God and quoted the Bible to prove it. They taught me that women were inferior to men by nature and quoted the Bible to prove it. They taught me it was okay to hate other religions and especially the Jews and quoted the Bible to prove it. And they taught me that homosexuals are either mentally sick or morally depraved and, of course, quoted the Bible to prove it. And so my life has sort of been an emergence out of the prejudices that my church planted in me.
We've always tried to raise up people who have had a profound change of heart. I'll never forget Dr. David Gushy talking with us about his book, which was literally titled Changing Our Mind About Inclusion of LGBT Persons in the Full Life of the Church.
And I worked in conservative enough environments for the better part of my career that I really had almost no encounters with LGBT people in my professional life and in my personal life either. So I was sadly ignorant of the actual life situations and challenges and discrimination and mistreatment facing now, you know, who I understand to be fully now my sisters and brothers in Christ, as well as people out in the broader society. I would say a starting point for this change for me was going to church in a congregation that was, without any specific effort, attracting lots of like formerly alienated or mistreated gay and lesbian Christians who were finding their way into our church. And some of them found their way into my Sunday school class where I teach the Bible every week, a very traditional activity. And then friendships began to develop and stories began to be told. And all of a sudden, my ignorance began to be pierced.
Of course, Rob Shank went through a very public change of heart on the big culture war issues and spent an hour on State of Belief talking very openly about all of that.
And that led to a second conversion in my life that I refer to as my conversion to Ronald Reagan Republican religion, which is distinctly different from Christianity. I didn't know that. And I came to know you really at the height of my career in that culture club and in that worldview. And that's why I couldn't have imagined a day when we would sit together like this way back then. But what I came to conflate was a kind of warped sense of patriotism and nationalism with the gospel of Jesus Christ. There came a time when there were days I couldn't tell the difference between Jesus and Ronald Reagan, or later, Jesus and George Bush, or Jesus and Clarence Thomas. I shifted between heavenly lords and earthly lords, and that became very disorienting and led me to a whole nother journey that lands me in this chair with you.
There was the young organizer for the National Organization for Marriage, Louis Marinelli, who renounced that anti-gay organization and went on to advocate for equality.
Well, what happened was basically the Summer for Marriage tour that I helped organize gave me the opportunity to go out onto the streets and meet gay people and lesbian people and their families. And that's what changed my heart from an opponent to advocate of civil marriage equality and just having the opportunity to meet some people face to face for the first time.
Now, that was a really interesting story because a few years later, he ended up in Russia helping build the California secession movement from there. He eventually came back and was supposed to run for governor this year, but it looks like he changed his mind on that as well. You know, it's always a thrill to get a big name on the show, but a lot of my favorite interviews have been with people creating profound change in their everyday lives, either because of something that happened to them or because they said, hey, I need to do something about a problem I am seeing. Sometimes we got to see a person grow. Zach Coplin was a high school kid who was being taught creationism in Louisiana public school, just like thousands of other kids. But Zach thought, wait a minute, this can't be right. And he became an effective activist.
There's been a couple phases of creationism, and until about 2005, before Dover versus Kitzmiller, creationism, they tried to insert it actively in schools. After Dover versus Kitzmiller, that cut out not only creationism, that was intelligent design. And so creationism isn't allowed to be taught as science anymore. So the way it's inserted into class is through code language, like critical thinking. Now, critical thinking is absolutely great, but you don't need a law to have schools teach critical thinking. My teachers are already teaching me how to think critically. That's part of their job description. Mm-hmm. And so these code words allow quote-unquote supplemental materials that don't need to be verified the way textbooks work. So they could be just about anything. And the real intent behind allowing these supplemental materials is to allow creationism in the class. And creationism is just not science. It's a religious viewpoint, and the whole idea is you teach science in science class and religion in church, in your mosque, in your whatever your place of worship is, that's where religion's taught. You go to Sunday school to learn it.
Brandon Robertson is a young gay Christian pastor who was also just starting in public life when we met him first. Now he's a magnet for right-wing attacks because he is so effective in his message. He has a huge, huge following on TikTok.
I think that there's a whole generation, my generation, the millennials, are looking at the evangelical faith that we've inherited, and we're seeing it have a long history of people like the religious right, Pat Robertson, the Jerry Falwell, and we see them starting off with a really great vision to be people of good news. But as they developed, we begin to see them, what seems to us as selling out and giving into power and political persuasion so that they can gain a platform, and in so doing, forsaking the core of the gospel of Jesus. And so what makes, I think, me and a lot of people in the millennial generation different is that we're going back and we're reexamining the words of Jesus once again. And what we're becoming convinced of, unfortunately, is that many leaders in the current evangelical system are far from, they don't reflect what Jesus looks like. We've moved from being people of good news to people of Fox News.
Paul and Welton, here's a question you can answer in two words, I hope. Who's the one that got away? Paul, who haven't you interviewed yet that you still hope to get a chance to do?
Pope Francis.
Paul? Okay, that's a goodie. We'll work on that. And Welton, who's the one you didn't get to interview?
You know, I can't tell you because I didn't have that goal. I got who I could get at the time. And when I saw that there was a possibility of it, I said, let's go. And most of the time we could do it.
Terrific. So I'm going to answer the question about my favorite guests because I had a much shorter career. Ted Johnson, who wrote the extraordinary book, When the Stars Begin to Fall, I think was one of the best interviews that I had the chance to do on State of Belief. And Reverend Rob Shank, who has had an extraordinary journey through all sorts of aspects of American religion, gave us two sensational interviews I was privileged to be a part of, and he'll be back. Paul, you're an ordained Baptist minister with a prominent family ancestry that I think can often be a blessing and a burden at the same time. How did your heritage inform your ministry and your interfaith focus?
Well, it's almost exclusively a blessing, I will say. I have long since given up the aim of being able to top my ancestry, but my goal is to honor my ancestry. part of it is the Walter Rauschenbusch legacy, actually, who was a major articulator of the social gospel. And it really actually, reading him helped make me a much better Christian. And understand, like, oh, this is exciting. The way he used language, the way he used prayer, the way he used just made me really love the faith. It gave me language I didn't know that existed. He was a beautiful writer, and so that has been extremely helpful. Also, the fact that he was great friends with Rabbi Stephen Wise and spoke at synagogues and a lot of black churches, black colleges. He showed a way of being in his own faith tradition, but also recognizing that you always have to be expanding that, speaking to people who don't necessarily think or believe exactly like you do, but finding common ground. And the other piece of that heritage is, of course, Louis Brandeis, who's was my other great-grandfather. And I grew up, my closest cousins were my Jewish cousins. I saw them all the time. We had great love for each other. We had great admiration for one another's families. I was raised within a Christian household, And they were raised within a Jewish household. And we recognize this strength of our families and recognize that we were going to work together no matter what. And as I have said before, like if heaven in the future doesn't include my Jewish cousins, I don't want to go there. So don't try to talk to me about the afterlife. I'm pretty clear about who I want to be hanging with. So anyway, that, you know, this has been influential. It's also been an important marriage between moving society forward towards constantly working hard to make this world a better place, and feeling that that is a religious mandate in the two faith traditions that I am, that my family represents, and that you can't have an individualistic faith without recognizing that what I do is completely tied in with what my neighbor is doing, and my well-being is tied in with theirs. So all of that has been a great blessing for me, and I have laid aside any goal of trying to compete with these legacies, but trying to honor them.
You know, I have to say, sociologically, I'm very curious. Marriage between Jews and Christians was not a very usual thing when your great grandparents were alive, even when your grandparents were alive. It's almost 100 years since these two icons lived. How did these two innovators in divergent faith traditions wind up?
It's great. I'm pleased to say that I am actually writing a biography of my grandmother's life, Elizabeth Brandeis, so the younger daughter of Louis Brandeis and Alice Goldmark. And I have actually come across the letters of courtship between my grandparents, one of whom was the son of Walter Rauschenbusch and the other one the daughter of Supreme Court Justice. And what was remarkable is that, you know, they were asking questions about everything, but what they both really, there was never a question around, like, will our faith traditions mesh? And in fact, I found a letter from Louis Brandeis to my grandfather, Paul Rauschenbusch, saying how much he admired Paul's father. And so there was absolutely, it is odd, and it is kind of hard to understand from a standpoint of, like, the question of interreligious marriage today. But what was interesting is that was not at all a factor in Elizabeth's family, in the Brandeis family. They were thrilled that she was meeting someone whose heritage meshed so much with their morality and what they felt was important. And I should say that, you know, we can talk more about this at some point, but Louis Brandeis was not brought up in a religious home at all, and by intention. He was never told that this was wrong. He married a daughter of an important Jewish man who Joseph Goldmark, but his mother said, I never wanted to raise my children with a belief that could be argued away. And so we raised them in the questions of morality, of truth, of charity, of, you know, valuing one another's. And so it's a history that I'm looking forward to sharing more in this book that's coming out. But in the meantime, it's something I've had people say, I had a Jewish woman come up to me after I spoke about my life a little bit at Chautauqua, and she said, your great grandfather would be rolling in his grave meeting Louis Brandeis. And I was like, you don't know him. You know what I mean? You know, but I understand why there's that concern. But in my family, that was not a concern. And I once asked my dad about it. Like, did that ever come up? And he said, never. Ever. And he knew, you know, he knew his grandfather was Louis Brandeis, and said that was never, ever a part of the family discussion.
May I just say to you, Paul, that after I went to seminary, the Rauschenbusch name was holy. And it was because, for me, for the first time in the Baptist people I was with, I saw people who finally made me say, I knew they were somewhere. I needed that. And I still go to his book and look at it. And you know what? That also has a relationship to Interfaith Alliance and also to our show, because the thing that really stunned me in the early days of the show were people who called us and said, look, we never knew a pastor that could talk like you talk. We never knew even more that we could have a Baptist that would be saying what you said. There was a guy that wrote us in the early day and said, we go and get in our swimming pool on Sunday night and we get something to drink with us and we listen every Sunday night to what you all are doing. And I thought, well, I've got somewhere close to what Rauschenbusch was doing.
Well, and I'll say I never heard anybody who talked like you either, but then I grew up in Chicago, and that explains a lot. Paul, I have a very strong Jewish identity, and it's a cornerstone of my being able to empathize deeply with marginalized and sometimes targeted groups. You are an openly gay man. You're married. You're a dad. How did your LGBT identity influence you? How difficult was coming out to yourself and then later to the public? And how has that informed your heart for those on the margins?
Well, I am very grateful for my life. I have been extremely fortunate to have been raised and surrounded by people who affirmed me. You know, my parents were kind of like, well, that's like, you know, that's a little awkward and uncomfortable, but very quickly, like, you know, that passed when I first came out. And I have been very fortunate because I was raised in a tradition where I never heard anything negative about gay people from the pulpit. I never, you know, I was kind of like, oh, wow, look, there's a lot of Christians who really don't like who I am. And that was, you know, but I also, you know, I'll tell you a story about one time when I was really wrestling with it, which was when I was, I started attending an amazing small Baptist church, Madison Avenue Baptist Church. I was working there when I went to seminary, and it was a small church that had one of everything because it was, you know, it was, we had the Upper East Side matron, but we also had transgender people. We had homeless people. We had people who barely spoke English. It was an amazing place. Everyone there felt like that church was a place they could be themselves and be home. And so that's how I became a Baptist, actually, is because I loved that small Baptist church and they wanted to ordain me. And I was very like honored to my bones that they would think that I was deserving of that. And so I moved forward and I was in Seattle working at another Baptist church that was welcoming and affirming, that was being kicked out because of its welcome and affirming status. And I was filled with rage. And I was like, why am I giving my life to this tradition that is treating these people, many of whom are straight, they're put, you know, so terribly? Why am I like giving credence to this? This is, you know, forget it. And I had done everything. I had been like, all I needed to do was go through the ceremony at this point. I had been approved. I said, I'm not doing it. I'm walking away. And a Baptist minister named Rod Romney, Reverend Rob Romney, who was the minister of First Baptist Seattle, said to me, Paul, too many people have worked too hard to get you to where you are today. You get ordained. You don't have to ever use it, but it is not just about you. And I was like, you know, he was 1,000% right. And I did go ahead and get ordained. And it was, that was a moment where I had to wrestle, like, Yeah, I can, you know, I am angry about it. And that anger continues when I see the way the church treats people who are, especially who didn't have the fortune of being raised in the tradition that I was, which was more accepting. It makes me furious, but it makes me even more want to be part of the fight, not just with queer people, but with people who are pushed to the side, whether that's economically, for race reasons, for immigration status, for gender. You know, these are all people who I feel called to be in community with and figure out a way to be together in the best way we can possibly be together. That's what I mean by fulfilling the traditions that I was handed to by Rauschenbusch and Brandeis and many, many others. And so I feel like, you know, being part of a marginalized group has been one of the greatest blessings of my life. Plus, it brought me to my husband. I can't imagine being with anybody else. And now we have two incredibly beautiful, wonderful, smart, hysterical kids. I mean, I couldn't have imagined a better life than I have right now. So I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it does wake me up with the right amount of anger, maybe righteous anger, if that's okay. And also a desire to be in community with people who are very different than myself.
I don't think you know how important that story is to people who are listening, because I've known people from lots of different traditions, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and others, who have reached that, I'll call it a Damascus Road moment, where they had to make a decision if they were going to go forward or just step off the path. And like you, so many of them, for the betterment of all of us, have decided to keep moving forward. Well, and you had a moment like that too. You started as a conservative and exclusionary Baptist and came to a recognition that that was no way for a person of faith to live. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Yes, I grew up in people who told me that everything they said to me, I needed to believe. And if I didn't believe them, I was probably going to hell. And I couldn't understand that. And so I began looking early on, saying, I don't believe that. Now, I wasn't telling anybody that. But I was in two churches that were very good churches. But they were also they wanted everybody to be the same way. And if you weren't their way, you weren't there. And I was trying to go into a pulpit and deal with that over and over. I have a good wife who listened to me a long time about what I was not going to say or what I was not going to do. And when the Southern Baptist Convention got really down, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it made me come out and say who I was and say, I am not putting up with that. I believe in this God. I believe what we're all about. And that's where I'm going, whatever else happens after that.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us, too. Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch is president and CEO of Interfaith Alliance, defending true religious freedom for all. At 10 o'clock on Wednesday, September 28th, 2022, Paul will host a briefing on Capitol Hill titled Christian Nationalism on the Ballot, featuring Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, Reverend Dr. Richard Sizek of Evangelicals for Democracy, Connie Ryan of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, Simranjeet Singh of the Aspen Institute, and voting rights advocate Taylor Coleman. For information on joining the live stream of this event, please visit interfaithalliance.org. Paul and Welton, thank you for taking this time to get together. I wish we had another hour or two to do this. Part 2 of this conversation will air next week on State of Belief Radio.